Very busy.
What are you guys doing?
Get yourself away from it. Pascal's on the phone.
Oh, yeah, Pascal's on the phone. All right, well, let's...
Who's on the phone?
No, Pascal had a call to... A quick call to Michelle. Well, I'll just start because there's, well, what I was supposed to do was to give a class on the so-called public-private partnership, but that's a very, very, very limited subject. It doesn't take much to refute that stuff. So what I'm going to do is that we're going to go through that, but from a more of a standpoint of the organizing, meaning that LaRouche in his paper, Project Genesis, he talks about the difference between event-driven and concept-driven. And so in order to understand where we are in history, to understand what there is to be done, you can't just look at events. You know, like people would be tempted to support the Tibetans, for example, right? It's the first thing you see. People would be tempted as well to bash the U.S., because there's a lot of events that give us a sense that the U.S. are doing bad things. But the real concept of thing, what's really going on, is that there's a fight between two systems, and it's not just two nations per se, right? We have to forget this idea that when we talk about the American system or the British system, we're dealing with two, in a sense, two ideas that gives us an idea of the concept, which is the historical concept in which we're in, is that what's at stake right now is the idea that the U.S. are embedding. So if you have, so when people talk about the U.S. becoming a new empire, for example, the real concept is that the United States is being under attack. So the idea is to destroy that nation, but also the concept that it embeds. Globalization as a concept will force nations to fit in the imperial system. So technically it might be a constitutional monarchy, it might be a republic, but you're forced to act as if you were an empire or a colony. Canada could be seen as some type of empire, right? Taking the cheap food from other nations, using the cheap labor. It's not a colony, but it fits, it goes more towards this idea of a colony than a real nation. So the concept itself is attacking nations and bringing them back gradually to the former system of imperialism, colonialism, you name it. And we see the same thing in when we organize, when we talk to people, because if you have a nation, for example, or a society that whose major sense of nation is something like Franklin Roosevelt, well, obviously your concept will not be will not function. Your idea of empire just won't last. Because opposed to, well, that's, isn't that the stupidest thing ever to have slaves, right? As anyone should say, and I think many people think. So there's a way that this concept is being forced onto people, and that's what we call sophistry. There's a you know, empire, and the empire as we see it today, the British Empire, does not necessarily control people through the military, although we see it like in Kenya, or we see the British Army wanting to go to Kosovo and things like that. But that might be a way that they control their quote-unquote colonies. But the way that the nations like Canada or the United States are being controlled or being forced to play the imperial role is this thing called sophistry. So that's the way I'm going to approach this PPP stuff and other things as well. We're going to look at many examples of sophistry, and we should look at how we can refute these things, and how how many times we're going to see the same type of quote was being said by a 57-year-old mother or a 18-year-old kid from Colombia or whatever. talking about first. First, I have a quote from LaRouche. Can someone read that?
This notion of oligarchical society is a typical opponent of the system represented by the Peace of Westphalia, and the opponent of the earlier efforts in that same direction under Charlemagne and under Friedrich Hohenstaufen, whose family was unfortunately butchered by the Venetian financier oligarchical interest controlling that century's crusaders. The British Empire of the period 1763 to 2008 to present date is a variety of such an imperial oligarchical model, which has served today as the British design for the proposed imperial tyranny of the draft Lisbon Treaty Organization, which is precisely such an imperial novelty crafted to disenfranchise the freedoms of the subjects, and even suppress the nominal European continental government, which Britain intends to dissolve into such a novel form of mere subjects of a greater British Empire. This greater British Empire is one which, according to current British official charter, may be ruled from its exterior by a self-defined as sublime deity, the United Kingdom, which reigns over hapless continental Europe, and which is not subject to those former nations of the continent over which it reigns. The foregoing considerations taken into account, the essential feature of this evil British imperial scheme is what is fairly described as the Neo-Malthusian fraud associated prominently today with the bloated figure of the former U.S. Vice President, global hoaxer, and current British imperial agent, the carbon-carrying Al Gore of 16 tons notoriety.
This refers to his family owning a mining company not known for its humanistic approach in Tennessee. All right, so I chose that LaRouche can set up a bit what we're facing. But also, if people remember the Treaty of Westphalia, the idea that LaRouche has been emphasizing more than once and also has defended in December at the conference in Ottawa, where the treaty basically represents three concepts, which has to do with the advantage of the other, this idea of not looking for revenge after a war that lasted for a very long time. So this concept of forgiveness and helping, as you're helping the other, the other nations around you as your first chore, for your first task. And I mean, to us and probably to a lot of other people, this will sound, yeah, I agree with that, right? But unfortunately, we're dealing with when you have a lot of cynicism and pessimism, bringing this idea of forgiveness might sound a bit stupid. Yeah, right, forgiveness, right? Or this idea that you have to help the other. It sounds cheesy, especially because especially environmentalism, which defined this very dark vision of men, but also, and we're going to see that a bit, but environmentalists usually, when they write books, they start by, their role is to attack the genesis. That's exactly what they go, they enumerate, and then they say, that's not true, you can't subdue, you can't multiply. That's exactly what they attack.
Before you forgive, don't you think it's important that the other party or the whole aggressor acknowledges something before you forgive, or will it be just being a coward and just being quiet?
What do you mean, they acknowledge that they did something wrong?
Yeah, that.
Well, after
the other party has to be willing also to let go of their ways or something like that.
Well, that's the thing about forgiveness, is that sometimes you will. If you have a war with, like, say, 16 or 20 nations, let's say, which lasts 30 years, You can start enumerating what was bad, you know, and trying to put degrees on it. Well, you killed 90 people there. Well, but I just killed 16 there. So, and then you get nowhere. But then your idea is to set up a new concept, right? So you say, well, okay, whatever I did, I recognize that I did that wrong, but I also recognize that this is going to be my new policy. The others might not agree. And the Treaty of Westphalia, got people to agree together on this concept.
Yeah, it cannot be just one country thing that asks for the other 19 countries.
No, because people are going to say, well, go to hell.
Yeah.
Say, you forgive us? Oh, yeah, well, who cares? But nations got together and said, okay, we're gonna put the past aside and look towards for the future. But even then, it wasn't like a perfect Europe. You know, that you had a war right away between Italy and France. Spain and France. But the concept is there. The new concept is there. So everyone is there for you to pick it up. All right, and there is this quote by Tony Blair about the Treaty of Westphalia that people have read before. But I think it's a good start to look at sophistry.
So for me, before September 11th, I was already reaching for a different philosophy in international relations from a traditional one that has held sway since the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. Namely, that a country's internal affairs are for it, and you don't interfere unless it threatens you, or breaches a treaty, or triggers an obligation of alliance. I did not consider Iraq fitted into this philosophy. Which brings me to the final point. It may well be that under international law as presently constituted, a regime can systematically brutalize and oppress its people. There is nothing anyone can do. And dialogue, diplomacy, and even sanctions fail unless it comes within the definition of a humanitarian catastrophe. Though the 300,000 remains in mass graves already found in Iraq might be thought by some to be something of a catastrophe, it may be the law, but should it be?
So that's a good example where, you know, what's his idea of the Treaty of Westphalia, for example? I mean, there's nothing about, well, he says, right, he says, it may well be that under international law as presently constituted, and then he says, basically says that this international law allows you to kill people. Say, because, thanks to the Treaty of Westphalia now, in my nation, I can just screw my whole nation, and that's thanks to the Treaty of Westphalia. And then Blair says, that's really what you want, right? This sovereignty. But that, if you look at the treaty, and we'll look a bit later, it's pretty long, but it has nothing to do with it. It's a very different concept than just saying, okay, each nation can do whatever they wish. Because that's what was happening during the war. Everyone was just insane and just killing Protestant, Catholic, whatever. Right, so, and
okay.
LaRouche.
The point here, as I see it so far, is really that, yeah, how can you do something for the interest of the people slaughtered or killed in another country if the law prohibits any intervention?
Yeah, that's the point. He wants to bring this idea that we can intervene. If there's a genocide someplace, you should be able to intervene. That's what Michael Ignatieff says as well, and others.
Yeah.
This idea of intervening in the name of morality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
you gotta look, right? Because he says, you know, I'm looking for something other than the Treaty of Westphalia, since, you know, even before 9/11. I don't want to have to deal with those protected nations, although the treaty has nothing to do really with just that idea of borders that you can intervene in.
Do you know this concept of responsibility to protect?
Okay.
Well, that's part of the. So you got to look at what is he really saying here? You know, he's part of a system that's created a problem. You've created situations of genocide. You know, funding Al Qaeda. You know, done all these things, and now all of a sudden you come up with a policy saying it's the responsibility of the nations that are in Europe or Canada to intervene. The U.S.
Yeah.
Intervene.
Okay. So, however,
on the thing you've created.
However, this is intention. The fact that this is distracting from what the damage is that is being done.
Well, the catch is, he says we need to intervene because there's a genocide. But actually, those who are saying that they want to intervene are usually those that are created the genocide.
Yeah, that's
even sanctions failed. Well, sanctions did not fail. It just weakened Iraq more.
Okay, but LaRouche explains well what he does. Is it that? Built. Okay, yeah, that's it. That's LaRouche again on the.
Okay, the idea of universal entropy, such as that expressed by the Hochsters Clausius, Grassmann, Kelvin et al., is thus exposed as not only a sophistry, but also a fraudulent one. The idea of universal entropy was not actually a fruit of the evidence, but built into the way in which they formulated the subject of the discussion. In the simplest pedagogical implication of this point, the assumption of a universal principle of entropy was the arbitrary, axiomatic, same sort of presumption upon which the edifice of the Malthusian lie has been premised. Then, and under the guidance of the notoriously fruity Charles, Prince of Wales, and his lying lackey, former Vice President Al Gore. It is the anti-entropy form of what is to be adduced as universal physical principles, which expresses the creativity through which the man and women, made in the likeness of the universe's creator, as stated in Genesis 1, express that likeness in relevant forms of creative action. So, implicitly, the friend of the Christian Apostle Peter, Philo of Alexandria, exposed that Aristotelian fraud, which was the presumption that the Creator himself was rendered impotent by the permanent lawfulness of his own creation, a lying sophist presumption of law, which relegated the management of the universe thereafter to the devil. And thus, to such true and faithful ears of that devil as the Tiberius of Capri's Roman and Lord Shelburne's British Empire.
So the key is in the first paragraph where he's talking about entropy, but says that the idea of universal entropy was not actually a fruit of the evidence, but built into the way in which they formulated the subject of the discussion. And this is a lot what we have to deal with, whether it's in the street or whether it's those PPP guys who are very annoying because they have their tricks. That's what we have to look at. We have to look at, in which concept are these guys into? Like, where do they situate? Where do we situate them in this concept of a fight for a republican system, meaning the general welfare, versus an imperial system, which is thinking more like Malthus, and. It's good that Val read those quotes from Kissinger, because I had one, not from Kissinger, but from someone else. Because there's something dangerous with fascism is that, or just bad ideas in general promoted by an empire. Sometimes it's so sneaky, that even slaves themselves would actually follow those ideas, right? You can get a slave to be completely afraid of freedom if you play well, and we see that even today. All right. So I have this quote of a neo first. Let's first what we're going to do is that we're going to look at the neo Malthusian, and then we're going to look at the real guy Malthus. It's in French, but it's going to be people should be okay. All right. So that's my neo Malthusian.
The critical question is how family planning policies can be made to work in the beds of the large and fast-growing countries such as India and Nigeria. India was the first developing country to launch a national population control policy in 1951. Since then, it has spent billions of dollars and claims to have prevented perhaps 70 million births. A recent study found that only 39% of couples use contraception, and population increase since 1951 is approaching 500 million people. The country's professed target of zero population growth by the end of the century seems a long way off. You got that guy that way.
I turn over.
India's government has tried every method to persuade its population to take up birth control. Sanjay Gandhi, eldest son of then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, offered transistor radios to men who would accept sterilization. Publicity campaigns have used pictures of very underfed young mothers to focus the issue on health and have argued that small families are rich families. Now, India is considering a return to a system of incentives. One model may be provided by neighboring Bangladesh, where fertility has become a traded commodity. There, during the 1980s, the government began to offer cash for sterilization. Applications soared when food became scarce during the floods of 1984. In some places at the time, women were given food aid only if they agreed to be sterilized. Despite such efforts, Bangladesh still has among the highest birth rates in the world.
David Suzuki! Wow. And Anita Gordon. It's a matter of survival.
Oh, man. Suzuki.
So imagine 10 pages of that, though.
Huh?
See, that's the point. The funny thing with Malthusian is that you never know when to end the quote.
Yeah,
it's all good. It's all insane. Right? Yeah, the whole scary...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He starts from, I don't know, 50 years in the future on all these fake reports about, you know, the world is a total disaster, everything's flooded in. All these stories is just people saying, oh, if only we had taken action back in the 1980s. That's what the whole thing
is about. So that's the neo-Malthusian. And it's funny, right? Because that's what I was saying. People would doubt, people wouldn't necessarily trust a guy like Kissinger, but everyone would kiss the feet of this guy. And I actually found that funny that he even mentioned India and Nigeria, just like, and Bangladesh as well. So same nations, but then you have a popular guy who doesn't have a nice suit, or he even gives interviews, and we had an interview where he cursed, right? He's like a typical popular guy, and you've seen him on TV for many years. Nice name, you know, nice pinch. So that's neo-Malthusian, and it's neo-Malthusian because it's neo-Malthusian, not because it's new, but also because Malthus doesn't even go that far.
Wait a second. You got a question? So the main problem with this is actually that if you go with Malthusianism in general, that if you stick to that theory, you're actually blocked and don't look at the possibilities how these calculations could be said, or what we could use as technology to provide better means to develop this. Is that correct? Is that the main criticism of it?
Well, yes, you could say that, but as I'm going to show, and unfortunately it's going to be in French, but we can translate rather quickly, because people have a sense of Malthus. But it's also, it's a very lame theory. Like, it's a sophistic theory. There's no science behind it, although...
It's just, danger.
Yeah. It's like, you know...
frightened and doesn't think anything.
Yeah, it's a bit like that, but we'll see. We'll see what he says, and you'll see why it concerns us today—not just here, but throughout the world—and why this has a link with the food, because we know that the food crisis. Some newspapers, like the Economist in London, was talking about a swelling, like a growing population as a main problem, which brings you to. Giving transistor radios to people, and even, you know, maybe if you have a food crisis, and then you tell people, I'm going to give you food if you cut your balls, actually maybe we're going to succeed. Thank you, David. Alright, so that's Malthus. The first part of the book, he just sets up his, you see his actions, how he got to this conclusion. But this is the second edition, so, and he says at the beginning of the second edition, he says, I took away some of the strongest proposals that I had, like the most harsh. So, as you'll see, he's a bit light, but still, if you want to read and see what nasty is, that's yeah, Pascal can read. Pascal can read, and then we can translate what people need.
Considérons maintenant la surface de la Terre, en posant comme condition qu'il ne sera plus possible d'avoir recours à l'émigration pour éviter la famine. Comptons pour 1000 millions le nombre des habitants actuels de la Terre. La race humaine croîtra selon la progression 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, etc. Tandis que les moyens de subsistance croîtront selon la progression 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Au bout de deux siècles, population et moyens de subsistance seront dans le rapport 256 à 9. Au bout de trois siècles, 4096 à 13. Après 2000 ans, la différence sera immense et incalculable. Le rythme d'accroissement de la population de période en période l'emporte donc tellement sur celui de l'augmentation des subsistances que pour maintenir le niveau et pour que la population existante trouve toujours des aliments en quantité suffisante, il faut qu'à chaque instant, une loi supérieure fasse obstacle à son extension. Il faut que la dure nécessité la soumette à son empire, et que celui de ces deux principes opposés dont l'action est tellement prépondérante soit contenu dans d'étroites limites. Okay. Dans Malthus, deuxième édition de Essai sur le principe de population, 1803.
Je suis choqué. Ok. Well, so should we translate parts of it?
Yeah, that might be
at the end, probably.
Well, because you see, the way he's calculating this geometric for people. The reason why he says 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 is after a calculation from Euler, actually, which is funny, of the death versus living ratio, and he gets to that number. And then he says, well, you know, population will grow so much that you need something above that that will prevent people from growing. So you need a superior law that will block this extension. So we need hard necessity to keep this growth under its yoke. But then he's going to talk about why he calculates 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 for the food.
Supposons que grâce à une excellente administration, la production des terres double dans les 25 premières années. Il est d'ailleurs probable que cette supposition excède la vraisemblance. Dans les 25 années suivantes, il est impossible d'espérer que la production puisse continuer à s'accroître au même rythme. Ce serait heurter toutes les notions acquises sur la fécondité du sol.
That's it. That's all he says about this. He says, oh, you might get it for the first 25 years, but after that, forget it, impossible. So that's the scientific basis of Malthus. So it's very lame. But it's something that you hear often, unfortunately. Right? It just can't happen, right? You're going to break all the rules of the idea of agriculture. So that's his basis for getting this calculation, this famous calculation that even people today will have in their brain, right? That's it, as I was saying at the beginning, right? You have a concept which leads the mind towards a certain frame, which might not be, people don't think about empire, they don't think about slavery, but they get into that frame. Okay, and now here's what he suggested, unlike Suzuki. It's similar, but it's not.
Le bonheur universel doit résulter du bonheur des individus en particulier. Il doit commencer avec lui. Il n'y a pas même besoin de coopération. Chaque pas mène à son but. Quiconque fera son devoir et recevra la récompense, quel que soit le nombre de ceux qui s'y dévouent. Ce devoir est à la portée de la plus faible intelligence. Il se réduit à ne pas mettre au monde des enfants si l'on n'est pas en état de les nourrir. L'évidence de ce précepte ne peut manquer de frapper lorsqu'on l'a débarrassé de l'obscurité dans laquelle le plonge les divers systèmes de bienfaisance publique et privée, et chacun sentira l'obligation qu'il lui impose.
So if we all do our little step, like, you know, if you're poor, you don't have kids, you can't sustain them, that's the first thing. And he says this should be obvious for everyone. After we got rid of the darkness created by those diverse system of charity, public and private charity. Right, so this idea of maintaining those poor, I mean, don't help them make kids, right? Don't get them, you know, to think that, you know, we really care about them, or that, see, they need to really understand that they can't make any kids. That's the last one.
Si nous voulons réellement améliorer de façon durable le sort des pauvres, ce que nous avons de mieux à faire est de leur exposer leur véritable situation et de leur faire comprendre que le seul moyen d'augmenter leur salaire est de diminuer le nombre de travailleurs. Puisqu'eux seuls fournissent le marché du travail, eux seuls ont le pouvoir de réaliser cet objectif.
If you really want to help the poor, what we have to tell them, it's a bit this family planning that I was talking about. You have to expose to them the real situation and get them to understand that if they want to have a bigger wage, we'll have to reduce the number of workers. I think we're getting into the Milton Friedman.
Yeah.
Right? And because the poor only are the ones in the work market, well, them only have the power to realize this objective. All right. Alright, so we have a very bad first mathematical reason, right, which says population grows like that, but food, come on, it's impossible. Maybe once, that's it. And then obviously, well, the poor is very targeted. You are the poor. You are the ones making babies, and you can't afford. The poor can't afford. So why make babies? And I mean, he's aiming also. He's aiming a lot at Ireland. You see that in the book.
At what?
At Ireland.
Oh.
Yeah. Says people in London, people in Scotland. You know, they made good choices, but you guys.
In Ireland, you're Christian.
You guys make babies. You think that with just potatoes, you'd be fine. And at a certain point as well, he says at the beginning, in terms of actions, he says that usually reason will bring someone to have less babies because they will realize the danger. So reason will make you stop making babies, and your animal instinct will just take over and you make babies like hell. All right, so that... I really wanted to show that guy because, again, you can quote a lot of things. But when we talk about the British Empire, right, you talk about an incentive, certain actions which are being promoted, which comes from somewhere. People might not say Malthus, but I met this guy from the Youth Action Montreal group, which is a group that invited Gore and Suzuki last year. He didn't know Malthus, but... Guy's insane. He's Captain Insano. Right.
Yeah, I listened to you. Wasn't.
Well, he listened to me because I said, I showed him the map and I said, this is the anti-Al Gore plan. Mm-hmm. What? And then I got his attention. Okay, so what I'm going to do because with the Russ.
Do Suzuki and Gore know about this?
Of course.
Probably that Gore talks about it in his book. Suzuki does. He does at the beginning. In this book, it's a matter of survival. Like he says something like, the time of Dr. Malthus has come. Not that prophetic. But something like, here's a situation, and that's what Malthus said. And maybe we should have, he doesn't say we should have listened, but it sounds... Well, you probably know, but... people don't know Malthus, people know Suzuki. And with those quotes, we kind of have made it that when we talk about this concept driven, right? You have Kissinger that defines the report, which is an impure report, and you have popular figure that picks up actually what's being said and makes it a popular part of the popular culture. Right? Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to have a couple of examples of those PPP guys because, public-private partnership. Yeah, I mean, the sophistry, what I want to look at is the sophistry, because in terms of connecting the dots and aiming at identifying the bad guys, there's not that much work to do. The problem is that the way it's being sold to people, you know, when LaRouche says the empire is dumb, it's not that wrong. Right? Is that we're dealing with people that are not that subtle. But the problem is that everyone gets, like the baby boomer culture, which are the ones, because they're the one in the elite and they're in the decision makers. They're all picking up on that stuff. So I'm gonna go through a couple of the sophistry and then I'm gonna see what LaRouche says about that. Well, I'm gonna see what LaRouche says about that further. Okay, so what I'm going to show you is two examples from a senatorial committee on hedge funds. Right, and that was a time where hedge funds were blowing apart, so people were concerned. And then there's a debate going on, obviously, on regulation, and the senators are asking, well, should we regulate, you know? Maybe if we had certain premises, we would have avoided the bad stuff. And the guy I'm going to show you argues about... the danger, like the organizational danger and the kind of individual danger as two different dangers, as your system being not the best maybe, and what individuals do. So, anyone, Mr. Mock?
Mr. Mock. I would say that in our own backyard we have two examples of fund to funds. Boris Alternative Asset Management Incorporated and Nordea Capital Partners Incorporated, where operational risk and alleged fraudulent activity took place. This is a big issue in this world and is not exclusive to hedge funds. It happened with BRIX, Enron, and many others, where hubris, human greed, and money are involved. These potentials exist. That is simply the reality of human nature. I would hasten to add that a sophisticated investor in any of these circumstances might still have invested. Perhaps there were some sophisticated investors involved in two of the cases mentioned above. I do not know that regulation would prevent this kind of operational or fraudulent failure. Regulation might create an environment of compliance only because it certainly did not prevent incidents such as happened with Enron or BRIX. Regulation is not a preventive measure, and where it is being touted as such, it is only preventive to the extent that it creates an environment of compliance. In that way, people have the sense that there is a standard and that the environment of investing is not akin to a Wild West show. Not sure that regulation of these kinds of groups would prevent anything. Mr. Ronald Mock, Vice President of Alternative Investments, had the same impression.
Just that people know, when he says a sophisticated investor, it's just someone that has a lot of money. Right, so he says, well, okay, well, we had these two cases where operational risk and alleged fraudulent activity took place. So, right, okay, he had corruption. And then he says, right, where hubris, human greed, and money are involved, these potentials exist. That could have corruption. That is simply the reality of human nature. Right? And then he says, well, these sophisticated investors might still have invested. Who knows? Perhaps there were some sophisticated investors involved in two of the cases mentioned above. But then you bring this question of regulation, right? He says, I'm not sure that regulation of these kinds of groups would prevent anything. You can put it there, but, you know, it's still people's decision. Yeah. So the fact that you're sophisticated, and that because of human nature, well, it's like, you know, you can put all these barriers, but you know human beings, you know how they are.
So you said
to
discourage any change.
Well, it for sure it does, but you know it's based on. I mean, he is there in front of a senatorial committee who probably is thinking about regulation, yeah, because right, they're seeing shitload of money being wiped out.
He's saying about regulation. He says like regulation might create an environment of compliance only because it certainly did not prevent incidents such as happened with Enron and BRIX.
So it
means that there were regulation at the time, and that, but what kind of regulation was there?
Well, yeah, if you have a regulation, only because it did not prevent incidents such as happened. Yeah, well, if you have a certain amount, because Enron is not. It's not like a hedge fund.
Oh, right.
It was crappy accounting and shit. It was a fraud.
Yeah.
But through a system which had certain regulation, but you know, well, obviously we're being torn apart since the 70s.
Yeah. That's what
you said. You can put regulation if you want, but yeah, you saw what happened with Enron. So it's not really safe.
Okay.
What? Well, no, he says regulation might create an environment of compliance. I guess it kind of sensitizes people, get aware about the problem. You might want to, right? You might want to follow certain regulations.
Yeah. Well, I say, like, you know, you might put a law that says you can't kill people, and they might obey it. You know,
yeah, it might force
the law is there, but you know, people are, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's people will break it.
So it says something like compliance, that nobody would actually want to follow these regulations because human nature prevents them from doing
what the weed is.
Yeah.
So the basic picture is again, human nature is actually evil.
Yeah.
And you can't trust them.
Yeah, so you have to control them. Well, that's what we want to look at, this question of sophistry. How you can spin things, and who actually is spinning that thing, right? And there was this thing here. Well, that's just about the sophisticated investors.
Have certain amounts of money and are likely to be smart enough to know what they want to do. More importantly, perhaps they are smart enough to realize that they should not mind.
Yeah, because this senator just says basically, he says it in other places more clearly, I think. But you know, look, these guys have so much money, and they have, why regulate? You know, they have to know what they're doing with their money. If they have a lot of money, that's because they managed to go through the system.
Right.
I think it says, well, which side of the regulation? The regulation.
$2 million to gain each.
Well, you can still argue, because that was at a time where I guess it wasn't as bad as today. But this question of sophisticated investor, that's something that comes up back again in the committee for a couple of days. Yeah, the guys that make money, like Warren Buffett. You want to regulate Warren Buffett? It's probably the case of innovative and whatever creative ways of making money. Okay, this is a couple, but I don't want to go through them all. Institut économique de Montréal, now we're getting into the PPP stuff. I'm going to show you who these guys are a bit later. But, right, first you got to think that how did the debate start? The debate started by having an invasion into the newspapers of the so-called innovative ID, and we have no choice but to have PPPs, tolls. Right, the government didn't do its job, right? And these institutes, what they do is that they go into these populist channels like Journal de Montréal or La Presse, right? Journal de Montréal, which is read throughout the province pretty much, and the type of newspaper that will show you how much your leaders, your political leaders, are earning, or every year, and show you this now. Like Stephen Harper wins $125,000 a year, and that's unjust. But they're not going to publish what the owner of Journal de Montréal earns every year, because that's like 10 times that amount anyway. So they play this populist approach, because as we're you know, fascism has to be people have to be convinced about those ideas somehow. That's when sophistry comes in. And I just showed that one. I'm going to read it myself, but it says that's in a short document that was on their website, which was used by the newspapers to promote PPPs. But it says le tarif, meaning on tolls, right? The tariffs on tolls. Le tarif serait plus important pour les camions afin de tenir compte de l'usure supplémentaire causée aux routes par la circulation de véhicules lourds. Ce qui éviterait de créer une subvention implicite à l'industrie du camionnage. So I use that one not to show that what they said at the end, right? The tariffs on trucks will be a lot heavier because we don't want a lower tariff to be some type of subvention. Implicit, huh? Like when you want to help someone, you give them money. Subvention. Subsidy. Subsidy. You don't want to give an implicit subsidy to the truck industry. That's what they're going to do. They're always going to attack, a bit like Schwarzenegger does, right? Well, so-called, how do you call it? The special interest. I've tried, like, your firefighters.
The nurses.
Yeah, the nurses, those bad, right?
It works to the teachers, though.
Yeah, obviously. They want you to learn how to write and read. Okay.
I think he needs
zero attention. Okay, what's next?
Where you come
from? Oh yeah, and here's a good one. Here's how you can deny reality and make it sound profitable. Someone else want to read?
Once the
La tarification optimale, qui est still on the toes. La tarification optimale varierait donc en fonction du coût de l'usure pour différents types de véhicules et de la sensibilité des usagers à la présence du péage. Dans le cas de la tarification d'une autoroute, les différents segments de marché sont 1. Les utilisateurs qui doivent se déplacer aux heures de pointe et qui devront payer un tarif plus élevé reflétant la demande supérieure lors de ces périodes. Et 2. Les utilisateurs qui peuvent se déplacer hors des heures de pointe et qui seront tentés de modifier leurs habitudes pour profiter du tarif moins élevé. Le recours à une telle structure de tarification encourage l'utilisation de la route hors des heures de pointe, ce qui aide à lutter contre les embouteillages. Okay. Okay, so wait, so basically the argument is say, well, we're going to fight against traffic, right? So obviously what we're going to do, that during the rush hour, we're going to make the price higher, and during the not rush hour, it'll be cheaper. So that people will force themselves to change their habit. Oh man, people are working, don't come in at night, I'm going to come at, you know, 1 p.m. This will just never work, because if you look at their stats, the rush hour is like from 6 to 10.
Yeah, right.
Right, so what? That just don't work. People gotta work. So you're gonna actually charge a shitload of people a lot more money than probably a guy on welfare who happens to have a car for a day gonna go under the bridge. That was just a very funny one. Right? Change your habits. You want me to lose my job or what? Yeah. Right. Right. Here's another good sophistry. Because you know, if you have tolls throughout Quebec. He says, par exemple, un aller-retour Montréal-Québec coûterait $30. Pour un banlieusard qui traverse un pont matin et soir aux heures de pointe, le coût quotidien serait de $4.80 pour un total annuel de $1,200. Ces montants peuvent paraître importants, mais ils reflètent la valeur du service reçu par les automobilistes, dont le coût est habituellement caché dans l'endettement du gouvernement. D'ailleurs, ces sommes ne représentent qu'une fraction du coût moyen d'utilisation d'une automobile, c'est-à-dire près de $10,000 par année. All right. So, they look, it's just going to cost you $1,200 a year or more. But it's okay, because it usually costs you $10,000. So when you make the proportion, it's not that much more.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Right? It's like they forget that it's an additional.
Only $11,000.
Yeah, now it's going to cost you $1,200 more, but it's not that much of a deal. All right. Right? And
this is Ellen
DeMarais.
I mean, I don't think it's exactly
a problem
for her.
No, she probably doesn't even have a car. She's probably flying a copter or something.
It's like teleport. It's like trying to sell you something. It's supposed to be like $100, but you don't really do it. And, oh, it's so reduced. The price is so reduced. You've got to buy it.
Yeah, that's.
You don't need it. I mean, so it's just, you just spend money.
And it's a very, you know, if you think about it, it's a, just take for a month, but it would be $100 a month.
What's a more practical, more long lasting?
Well, you make no tolls.
Who came up with that idea anyway?
Well, that's what we're going to see. Maybe we're going to see it soon. It's every day, if you take the bridge every day. No, that's another example. When he says le coût quotidien, when you cross a bridge, it says for a banlieusard, like for a guy from the city or in the suburb. For a guy from the suburb who crosses a bridge day and night at rush hour, the daily cost is $4.80. And the whole year it will cost you $1,200.
I have a plan. You should like get people to live on the island.
Duh. Alright, what's the other one? Alright, if you want to have an idea, okay, we can read it. Have an idea of what do these guys mean by something which is just or not just. That that goes in this question of the pay-as-you-go principle. It's interesting to see it. You want to read the...
Okay. Dans son plan de transport dévoilé en mai 2007, la ville de Montréal envisageait de recourir au péage pour financer le transport en commun. Ainsi, les utilisateurs du réseau routier qui paieraient les droits de passage subventionneraient la clientèle du transport public. Cela constituerait un interfinancement entre les différents modes de transport qui contreviendrait au principe de l'utilisateur payeur, pay as you go. On obligerait ainsi une catégorie de citoyens à assumer le coût des déplacements d'autres personnes, ce qui ne serait ni juste ni efficace. Par ailleurs, on ne peut évoquer la question de la pollution pour appuyer cette mesure, puisque les automobilistes compensent déjà amplement le coût de leurs émissions de gaz à effet de serre en payant la taxe sur l'essence.
All right, so now we have the first idea of justice, right? Because the idea what they have is that if you pay a toll, the money that is being raised will stay for the toll, for the road, right? Because that was the principle. You pay for a road, so obviously we're going to use the money for the road.
Which is probably okay.
Well, what they usually tend to do is to add some fees, as I'm going to talk about later. But they, right, because the first idea is to say, okay, well, let's raise the money to buy trains or to buy a metro, you know. But then it says, well, no, that's against the pay-as-you-go principle, that you can't just use money for other things. So you want to force these citizens to pay the cost of transportation of other people, which would be unfair and inefficient.
Where is efficiency coming in?
Well, you see, if you think of a certain sum of money being channeled for a certain project, you might argue from the accounting standpoint that this is better for your road. Right, you pay for your road, so more money there. But the problem is this question of you don't want to have citizens to pay for other people's transportation, which would be unjust. Well, if you look at if you pay every day for going on the road, you want your money that you spend to be used on the road to have the best road possible.
Right.
You don't want your money to be used for subway. Uh-huh. That won't help your road.
Right.
So, but they say that this is unjust. If you use money for trains, this is unjust and inefficient. So and that's important because this pay-as-you-go stuff, right? I mean, it might sound cool for a highway, but if you think about a hospital, then you get screwed. Then the pay-as-you-go principle is actually going to prevent any type of real development of your healthcare system. And the fact that you pay for everyone, actually, you're going to, even if you're going to be healthy all your life until you're 76, or even in the school system, like even people that are single, pay taxes that go for the healthcare, for the school system. That's how you all chip in, and right. So the pay as you go brings you to this question. Well, what do they mean by justice? What is it that? Why couldn't I help someone else get a subway, which is more efficient? Which has nothing to do really with the pollution thing. A subway is just more efficient in the sense centralized area, right? Because this comes up often, the pay-as-you-go thing.
Right.
It comes up in any institution defending the PPPs, whether it's the Fraser Institute. Like, for example, I think it's the next... But the Fraser Institute will argue... It will argue about the government's mistake, and then you say, well, now we need to be innovative, so we're going to bring this thing in. Right? Like, it's easy when you look at Quebec, right? Since the Pont de la Concorde collapsed, Viaduc de la Concorde collapsed in Laval. So the Fraser Institute starts from there and shows how the viaduct was so badly built in the 70s. And that today, I mean, we have so many other bridges to repair. So it's the government's fault. So therefore, the private is going to kick in. And the private, as you'll see, they have wisdom or whatever. Yeah. All right. So now it starts. This is a very good one because it gives you a sense of how they see the government. So, il est souhaitable de concevoir le retour des péages. So we want to have the return of tolls dans une approche réseau et non seulement dans le cadre de la réalisation de projets particuliers. So not just for one highway, but for the whole system, so all the provinces of Quebec. Ainsi, il serait logique d'étendre graduellement les péages sur toutes les autoroutes ayant un volume de circulation suffisant comme cela se fait dans plusieurs pays. Okay, so all the roads. Now that's a good thing. Afin de réduire le risque, de favoriser l'innovation et surtout d'éviter que l'État soit tenté de piger dans les recettes des péages à d'autres fins que l'entretien et la réfection des infrastructures, il serait souhaitable que les nouveaux péages soient mis en place sous forme de PPP. So you want to reduce the risk, right? You want to favor innovation, whatever. And especially, you want to avoid the state from nitpicking in your money and take money from those tolls and use it for the means. And that's because we need PPP.
Because PPP. The government is not trustworthy enough.
Exactly.
As they would use the money for the people, so we trust private people.
Yeah.
And you know how to make sure each and every penny out of people.
Yeah, great. I'm looking forward to it.
Not able to do that, without a lot on the street. Okay. Alright, so now other people in favor of PPP, but that's... See, the idea that this last quote about the state is going to come back subtly, I would say, in different speeches. That's a speech where I'm going to show you is an excerpt, short excerpt, just to show you a bit. Of Gordon Campbell, who was the premier of BC. And it was at a speech at some Vancouver, I think the Vancouver Board of Trade. But I'm just going to show you the first part and then I'm going to tell you what his real thing. It's in English.
Still remember when Governor Schwarzenegger came to British Columbia? Do any of you remember that? Well, I certainly remember it. Governor Schwarzenegger was a very effervescent guy. He's got lots going for them. He did a State of the State address earlier this year. You may have missed it, but you should have heard it. This is what he said. In British Columbia, public-private partnerships are common for building highways, bridges, rapid transit, water treatment, and so on. And everyone is happy. Political leaders are happy, business is happy, the public is happy, the economy is happy.
So what type of argument is that?
Especially
for the whole
financial
pursuit of happiness?
Yeah.
Wasn't Gordon Campbell the same that was pushing also for legalizing of drugs?
In BC, possibly. That's the yeah. And what the Premier Gordon will do, I'm just going to explain it quick because it's a bit long. But what he does to promote PPP is first he takes this crazy example of an hospital that they were building in BC. I think it was the I'm going to show you. The Patterson Pavilion. It wasn't even the hospital, it was just the pavilion. No, don't read. I'm just gonna explain it to you because it's a bit long for nothing. But actually, what they happened to do is they build the building, mm-hmm. and then the contractor has forgotten that he had to put equipment in the building, right? And obviously, this was a government contractor, a mistake. And it actually took 20 years for this building to be used for anything, right? So that's his first argument. Against the government contracting. And then he brings the PPP as an example and says, okay, well, we had this asbestos hospital Oh yeah, I'm gonna That's not relevant, but because we had this asbestos hospital that took, you know, 3 years to build, so a lot faster than 20 years, if you can't find. And that was done by PPP, so therefore that's good. And now, here's what he's going to do about what he learned from PPP. That's all I can read.
I think that public-private partnerships, from my perspective, have been a huge success. They are not the only answer to the challenges we face, the infrastructure challenges we face in the 21st century, but they are certainly going to be a critically important one as we move through the next couple of decades. They give us an opportunity not just to find more cost-effective means of building buildings, they give us an opportunity to think as we should about the life cycle of buildings, the impact on operating profits that we can build. They give us an opportunity to think about how we can build buildings or design infrastructure so that we're thinking about the long-term upgrades and rehabilitation that may be made. They give us the opportunity to think about how we can meet some of our climate initiatives with regard to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and other challenges that we face like that. They give us the chance to think of our infrastructure in terms of its long-term life cycle, what the maintenance requirements are, how we deal with what with that over the long term. All of those things are going to be critical to us, not just to us, not just improving our infrastructure, but to sustain it over the long haul. Amazing how it says nothing.
Well,
they are giving us.
What amazes me is that, yeah, I mean, now that we can talk with those PPPs, now we can think long term, right? Now we know how to build things. You know, is the BC government retarded? Is it been retarded for 100 years? That it didn't think about that before it talked to the PPP, right?
Because it's
like when the government gives a contract to a private guy, it doesn't talk to him. Doesn't tell him you should fill up this hospital, by the way. But it's just very stupid. But then when the public does it, then the private does it, you know, then we're able to discuss and see how do we do it long term again? Right. Which is the government.
Because business has a strong record thinking in the long term.
Obviously, you know.
How to make the more money for the longest time.
Sound like their mindset.
Yeah, we see that with the hedge funds. You know, these guys are building a strong economy that is dying right now, but it's okay.
So how do you ensure that the government and the government institutions have that,
Well, we've got to realize who we're dealing with, who we're looking at. And I'm going to end, and then we'll have more to answer. Because we all keep this question of the baby boomer in mind. You gotta think. We're here and we're kind of laughing at those guys being really a bunch of morons. But there's a culture that fell into this hole of sophistry. And I'm going to show you, I think now it's Jim Flaherty, the Finance Minister, Canadian Council for PPP. Someone can read it. Now, let's talk with them for the first time ever, because we need to talk with them. And we just don't know how to build things. Right, so you see this question of the wealth of experience, question of the innovation, right? But technically, okay. So I'll just end with the boomer thing, because you got to think the sophistry and the boomer stuff can lead you very far into hell. So I'm going to show you a very short clip of the Quebec Finance Minister in 2003 during his budget speech. It's in French, but you'll hear how you'll see how people you will hear the shift that happened in the 60s. You will hear the shift. Okay. Oh yeah, you will.
Well, the sound.
Okay, you guys can hear? You guys can hear? Okay. This is the very end. He's concluding his speech, pretty much. Okay, and not just listen to what he says, but hear the response. Hear the response of all the big rumors of the world. The cultural paradigm shift.
Oh man.
But what did he say?
He says, don't ask what your country can do for you, but what you can do without him. Without him.
I'm going to play it again.
Well, with the state. I'm talking about the state. About the state. But he's like, he's kind of quoting his identity. Yeah, totally bastard.
I'll play it again. Okay, remember John F. Kennedy? Right. Don't ask what your country can do for you, but ask yourself what you can do for your country. Okay. And now there's the boomer perversion. And you think I like the idea, right? Your finance minister tells you, well, no, forget about what I'm going to do for you.
Who needs Washington?
But if you have your employer or your employee who comes and tell you that, you know, don't ask you what I can do for you, but ask you what you can do without me. It's not going to work. You're going to lose your job. So, but this is the boomer perversion. This is the sophistry up to an extent which is just ridiculous, where the finance minister of the province of Quebec tells in the National Assembly that basically the government should take a hike, and the other parliamentarians are applauding. Right?
Well, no welfare for you guys.
Not just a little bit.
They're going to lose their job.
Okay, yeah.
If they've been in for three, it was all the three-termers. Right? They're the ones that were clapping. So they're the ones that get the pension.
Probably.
Right.
So that was it for the boomer sophistry stuff. Oh, that's the. All right. So who is behind those PPP stuff? All right. So that's a picture that was taken not too long ago when Paul Desmarais got a medal, and I think it's called a Légion d'honneur from France. It's a very rare medal. It's like 60 people in the world that have that medal. And so you have French President Sarkozy, you have Prime Minister Premier Jean Charest, and you have Desmarais Senior, who doesn't go out often. And l'Institut économique de Montréal that we saw, one of the members of that institution is Hélène Desmarais, which is a daughter-in-law of that guy, which is the wife of Paul Desmarais Junior, who is now the president. So, and if people have a sense of who Sarkozy is, this is a guy who went to England and says, let's have a new Entente Cordiale. This is a guy talking about sending French troops in Afghanistan again. We've called him Sarko-Léon, or like Napoleon. So here's what he says, what he said in front of everyone about Paul Desmarais. This guy, you want to read?
Un trio inquiétant. Paul Desmarais, le seigneur, Nicolas Sarkozy et Jean Charest. Si je suis aujourd'hui président, je dois en partie au conseil, à l'amitié et à la fidélité de Paul Desmarais. Un homme m'a invité au Québec dans sa famille. Nous marchions de longues heures en forêt. Et il me disait, il faut que tu t'accroches. Tu vas y arriver. Il faut que nous bâtissions une stratégie pour toi.
All right, so that's kind of So they're good buddies. And it's very, I don't know why Charest is there, but but he's there, you know.
What about him? What is his philosophy?
Well, I don't think he has any, but I think he's, see, this guy and others, well, this guy, when he was 28, he was the minister, I think it's called Youth Affairs or something, for the federal government under Brian Mulroney.
Jean
Charest, yeah. So when you're 28 years old and you're a minister with Brian Mulroney, you're setting towards a certain agenda, which probably has to do a lot with Power Corp, which is the institution, the asset management institution that is owned by Mr. Desmarais and the whole family and other people. And the last, all the prime ministers since Pierre Trudeau, except Harper, all worked for Power Corp in a different way. So Pierre Trudeau, Jean Charest, Brian Mulroney, Jean Chrétien, Brian Mulroney, and Paul Martin. They all come from that Power Corp, which owns the two biggest insurance company in Canada, which is another reason why they're attacking the healthcare system. I think we should have a tier system, because then you can sell insurance like crazy. And people will get dependent on those insurance, like in the United States. Well, that your only chance to have health care is to make sure you get, so your insurance becomes a priority above other things. So, but if these guys start playing with the numbers and charge you more, then you're screwed. Whether you follow that, or you're going to get any health care. And then, as you know, okay, what's next? All right, so just to make a link with this question of fascism and what Val was talking about in terms of imperialist people like Kissinger or people from the so-called British Empire. What you have here is a little drawing of basically links between the Desmarais family and the Frère family, which is another big family involved in the finance, was also one of those institutions that backed up Nazis, and are now involved. For example, you see this company, Suez? Yeah, Suez is one of those companies that owns a shitload of things, which are based on energy or water management, and they were involved in Argentina, and I think in 2006, the president had to kick them out because they just didn't do anything. They were there for like 10 years, and you had a level of nitrate that was like 200% norm in the water. And the only thing that they did is to send a paper to all the families saying, well, you might not want to have your kids drink water today. Right? That was their action. So they said, well, and a lot of also financial schemes around the company. So they were kicked out. But that was, that links us also with Felix Rohatyn, who's a former member of the Frères, Lazare Frères Bank, the New York faction, who also was also the ambassador of the United States in France, right? And as we see later, there's other links with that. And you have something like, you see this thing, Paragesa? Is it Paragesa? Yeah. It's par, I think, yeah, I think it's Paragesa. Paragesa owns La Presse. Right? And guess who invited my good friend Al Gore on the 4th of April? La Presse, okay. 2,000 tickets just for La Presse subscribers. And obviously, before the show, you had André Desmarais, which is the brother of Paul Junior, and some other guy who, just to show how degenerate these guys are, they met Al Gore and they say, hey, we're going to give you a gift. And they gave them a Canadian Montreal hockey jersey.
Oh, right.
With, I think it was number one Gore. And they had a meeting before, and that's the funny thing, because that's when you can start smelling the cat between the two each one. When Al Gore went to this meeting, when you had Jean Charest again, you had Mario Dumont, who's one of the opposition leaders in Quebec, you had Paul Desmarais, junior, I think, senior SPO, and for some reason, what's being reported in the media is that Gore said that Jean Chrétien was a good leader. He was a leader in greenhouse gases and stuff, etc., etc. And, I mean, whatever, maybe. But why, see, then you can see that there's probably a poor schmo, like Jean Charest. I don't know exactly who he is and what he has in mind. But he's obviously going to be pushed to do a lot of things around Gore, around this question about congestion tax, as I was talking before, which is another of these populist leftist idea. And Cheminade in one of his articles that he wrote in, I think, 2007, called Let's Stop Selling France. He goes into a lot of those networks and he shows how the Desmarais, Paul Desmarais Sr. and Albert Frère, who's the head of the Frère family, are, and as we see in this graph also, are very linked in terms of not just buying stuff, but, like, I mean, Total, that's oil. And Suez also is, when you look at the Lyonnaise des Eaux, and also they were trying to buy, or they did, they were trying to buy Énergie de France, which I think has to do with more nuclear, but it's basically energy. So when you think about PPPs where people are being leased, where the private companies are being are having a lease on your infrastructure and then using it, putting tolls or whatever, then you have these asset management guys which are buying stuff and dismantling things. There's a definite attack on the infrastructure of nations made by those type of entities, right? What's next? Oh, yeah. All right, so for some reason, which I don't know, but the Paul Desmarais is the commander of the Order of Leopold II, first cousin to Queen Victoria of the United Kingdom. And he was there in 1865-1909. Yeah, which is the main time that Rob stressed out during his class, where the when we were asking when did World War I start, well, Rob said it's a victory of Lincoln over the Confederacy, and there was also something with Belgium, where Belgium was used in order to create a situation where there would be an aggression on Belgium, then you would justify a war, a different intervention. Because you got to remember, right? Belgium, when you think Belgium, you think Congo. Right? So you think about slave trade, you think about colonialism, big time.
Rwanda.
Probably, yeah. But Rwanda is, well,
yeah, because they kind of cemented the schism between the Hutu and Tutsi.
Well, you see, yeah, that was we published some stuff about Barrick Gold, this mining company that did, which is in Congo, which is in that area of planting mercenaries and stuff, and Desmarais is on that board as well. Because you see, and that's the thing, we should I mean, if you're the commander of the Order of Leopold II, it's not just some funny thing, right? I got my medal now. Or the la Légion d'honneur in France. I mean, you give that to the type of medal you would give to astronauts or people that saved or made a quasi miracle, you see. Right? But then Paul Desmarais, he's just saying, that's Paul Desmarais, you know, that's grabbing stuff and grabbing more stuff, using gore for whatever. And his wife, you know, like Hélène, not his wife, but Hélène Desmarais, the wife of Paul Desmarais Junior, has also been named in the board of Garda. And Garda is a private security company, right? And as we know, Rohatyn, I think I'll show, right? Rohatyn in a conference, do I have it? All right. In a conference about privatizing the military, this is what he said. He says, I will address this issue as privatization and what goes with it, not if it's good or bad, because I think it's here to stay. There's no point in arguing that issue. It's another sophistry there. Let's go back up. Alright. Well, alright, so I'm showing these guys here, fascism in the city states. Yeah, someone had a question? No? Okay. I don't know if all these guys, you have Michael Bloomberg, the big one. You have Rohatyn, the guy, you look happy. You have Jean Charest, and you have the mayor Tremblay, Gérald Tremblay. I won't agree about their knowing, or they're just boomers, right? I might be a mixture of both.
Well,
yeah, I mean more, yeah, I'm sorry. More like Jean Charest or Tremblay. Makes more sense. So maybe these guys are just two really retarded boomers, but let's take that option for now. So you're retarded. Alright. And we published some stuff about that, but when you think fascism, like the PPP, that's why we're saying it's rather limited. This is one thing among many other things. Okay, PPP or two-tier system healthcare, or this thing that we're going to see at the city-state where there's a group of people involving Rohatyn, Bloomberg. There's also the Paris mayor and Mayor Tremblay. Different groups that are involved in decentralizing cities out of the out of the basically the ruling of the nation or the province itself, or even the region. Right? And there's another good amount of sophistry. But if you think about this question of tolls, not just for a city, but think about a complete huge network of cities who all each have their own tolls, right? Think about a truck that goes from Mexico to Montreal, let's say in 3 days, how many tolls you would have to go through. Now think about your pineapple that just arrived in Montreal, how much it's going to cost you more because of these tolls. Right, that's the system of the city-state that was there during the Lombard League. And that's a system that is just pretty fucked up because each city, if decentralized, then they get more power. They can know, find different ways to raise money. The toll is obviously a good way. But then each truck, you know, and our society in North America, we still have a lot of trucks and probably too much trucks. So each of these trucks with products in them, they don't get just like $4 a day, right? If you go in a 407, which is in Ontario, I think it's for a car it's 18 cents a kilometer, and for the truck it's 56 cents for each kilometer. So if you have about 60 kilometers, so that's about $30 if you stay on the 407, which is a private PPP highway. But if you do that 7 times in your travel, well, 7 times 30, that's $210 more to a truck has to go through. That's when your economy starts to suffer a shitload. Well, yeah, or who's going to pay this extra? It's actually the population. Increase the price of your products. Okay, this has to do with Law 22, which is a law which is being promoted in the province of Quebec in order to give more power to Montreal. Right? And it's a problem because, as I'll talk a bit about, well, I should talk about it right now, Mayor Tremblay is involved in different groups involving different cities. Like, for example, the International Group of French-Speaking Mayors, right, which involves Bertrand Delanoë, mayor of Paris, and he's the vice president. And so you would think, well, they probably talk about French, you know, French stuff, and how can you have more French this, more French that? But it's actually not the case at all. They all speak French, but what they talk about is, should they have a certain number of commissions, right? They're here. So that's on the French mayor's organization. So the first commission is decentralization and local democracy. That's a big action that they always promote, right? Local democracy, like local government, and decentralization. And then you have urban stable development, service, you know, it's like and politique de santé locale, aide humanitaire, because these groups involve a lot of African nations, which is a funny paradox. But like the first commission is decentralization, and that's something you're going to find also in this, Tremblay is also he's a vice president of the North American branch of a bigger group called United Cities and Local Government. That's under the UN. That's bigger. And the first thing is decentralization again in local democracy. And I'm going to show you a couple of those. Sophistry. Because that's all it lies on. The only way that they can sell their thing is by getting you to. Believe in it. Well, let's start with that. That was from one of our magazines. Someone wants to read that?
If there is one theme that I would like to impart during this session, it is the 19th century was the century of empires. The 20th century was the century of nation states. The 21st century will be a century of cities. Our cities, Mayor Webb continued, are economic engines that drive our respective nations' economies. And through our collective efforts and partnership, we can fully claim the role of international economic and cultural brokers.
All right. This one is a good sophistry for someone who doesn't know much about economics.
Our cities will be both the heart and soul of this historic and global transformation. And globalization gives us new opportunities for partnership. Our regional economies have emerged as the engines that drive our national economies. In the United States,
our metro economies accounted in 1998 for 84% of national gross domestic product and 84% of national employment. In the United States, both political parties are coming to recognize the growing importance of cities and metropolitan regions, and the federal government is slowly ceding more authority on issues such as healthcare, transportation, economic development, and welfare to state and local governments.
All right, so what's wrong with that? Sounds nice, okay.
Now, but what about the rural areas and built by the 42 by... I was thinking that if you separate the cities from the nation state, the rest of the people are fucked.
Yeah, exactly. And the people from the city too, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we have these developments, and I was thinking about that suburbs are separating themselves from the city. Rich suburbs in American cities are separating themselves so they can, you know, they don't have to share with the poorer areas, maybe the city, in the center of the city. And that's the kind of thing that they separate so they don't have to share that.
You get that problem for Montreal, for example. They keep whining that people coming to Montreal, like in Laval or whatever, they don't pay the home taxes.
Yeah.
So then Montreal is losing money, but everyone comes to Montreal. But that's a sophistry. Okay, you can say, right, in the United States, our metro economy is accounted in 1998 for 84% of national gross domestic product and 84% of national employment. Well, okay, fine, but because of that, like, you want to separate, you want to decentralize. Well, what made you a city first? Right?
Yeah.
There's no dynamic whatsoever. It's just, this is what we did yesterday, we got all this GDP, and screw the rest.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of just obvious, you're just saying the truth, but it's kind of, it's always been like that, like cities, you know, like when you want to do something, you get together.
Yeah,
well, you want to create wealth, well, you get together.
Well, the problem is that the GDP per se, that's a fraudulent measure. So obviously, if you're in New York, you have 14 million people exchanging money.
Yeah, right.
It's more than in Mississauga, I guess. Okay. That's another in the same sense. If city and county metro economies were ranked with the economies of nations, 47 of the world's top 100 economies would be U.S. metropolitan areas. Counties and cities are quickly overtaking many state economic engines. That was in Lyon. The first big conference that happened was in Lyon, in France. What else we got here? Okay, and then comes the green aspect. There's a good reason why I chose Malthus, where it happens to fit well with Val's briefing. But we're talking about when LaRouche his first quote was to talk about the empire as a Malthusian system or neo-Malthusian, and that's where the green stuff comes in, and that's when we have to attack this green. But all the green policies that you're going to see will be, I'm sure, they will be dipped once, twice, thrice in a lot of the sophistry. It'll be our role to refute all that and to really laugh very loud at all this. To get people to laugh at themselves as well. Alright, so that's Bloomberg. Who want to read?
September 21st, 2006, Bloomberg Press release proudly announced as a key component of the plan includes the undertaking of a major greenhouse gas inventory for city government and the city overall. We intend to make New York City a national leader in meeting the challenge of making ours an environmentally sustainable city. and the constant threat of global warming means that we have to think about the urban heat island effect that makes our summer days even hotter than the Greek areas of our cities.
And he tried to pass a law. He tried to pass a congestion tax, which was debunked the New York City Council.
The constant threat of global warming is just the way we're at. And the constant threat that is always going to be there. Global warming. You have to constantly
take out. See, that's another one. That's a big one because then he was with Al Gore.
On February 11, 2009, Bloomberg addressed the United Nations Conference on Climate Change and made clear that his zenith tree matched that of Al Gore. It has been not quite 2 months since the close of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in Bali. And it was my privilege to address that convention at the invitation of ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability, a worldwide network of more than 700 cities and counties that, like New York City, are actively engaged in combating climate change. Bloomberg insisted that the United States must set firm carbon reduction goals and fully implement them gradually. It's clear that the world cannot wait for 2009. Global warming demands immediate action. As the New York Times columnist Tom Friedman warned in a report summing up the Bali conference, on this issue it's too late for later. The world's great cities recognize that, so we are not waiting for others to act first. And it's why the mayors of many of the world's largest cities have joined forces to fight climate change in the C40 organization. It's why, even though our national government has yet to approve the Kyoto Protocol, more than 700 cities in the United States, representing more than 80 million Americans, have pledged to meet its goals.
Right. And when you look at all the institutions where you see, whenever you have a group of cities, and especially those, like every time Mayor Tremblay, for example, is involved, decentralization, climate change, these main things popping, and so maybe we'll have stuff like PPP being promoted, you get these cities looking for decentralization, you have these people looking for any type of taxation, you have a financial system which is collapsing, and as John Alpo was saying in the, I think it was in the Empire Suicide Club article, where these guys, financiers, some of them will lose big, and you have some of those guys trying to bring a certain amount of money in order to buy something which is solid. It's going to be infrastructure, it's going to be a bunch of other things, right? So you have, you made $10 billion out of nothing, you're about to lose it, well, try to buy something. And like, for example, in BC, you have this Australian bank, been called Macquarie, who is an example of those banks which are about to blow, like they are as bad as Bear Stearns could be. And the idea is that by having this bank buying infrastructure, for example, whenever these guys blow apart, the real owners of the bank, who were not involved in that bank, they're not that crazy, and they put their money there. And then these guys become the owners of the company, because the bank was being owned by these guys, so through another group. Like the bank of Macquarie goes obviously to England and it's Australian.
I have a question. How come that the US government resisted the Kyoto Protocol?
Which?
The US.
The US government?
Uh-huh.
Resisted the Kyoto still in the sign of the Kyoto Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
How is that serving their interests? Or, I mean, if you say that the Kyoto Protocol is actually, it's coming from this idea of overpopulation and that we have to go for, how does it fit together? I don't see what that's
coming from.
Okay, you're saying that the Americans, because they have Bush and all these guys, they should be going towards. If global warming is a big thing that's going to destroy nations, why don't they go with it?
Yeah, for example, or if you say that global warming isn't a big thing, that this began in the story, that how come that the U.S. government doesn't support it?
Well, you had the U.S., you had the Russians, you had Canadians. Population wasn't supported, the government didn't support it. I mean, I would say it might be a couple of things. It might be just like some people were saying, the oil cartel. That's possible. But I think the real thing is that we have to look. I would say, I don't know, I don't have the perfect reason, but we could suppose that there's some networks in the U.S. that know how bad this thing can be. Because, like for example, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, they all greenies. They're green, like boomer green, that you would never believe. That's something they always promote in front. And I think it was 2006 where you had a Bill Clinton that came to Montreal on discuss about that. He has his own Clinton group. Maritime Bay gave the first speech, right? So it might be different things. Might just be the old cartel, but the idea is that, just for the same reason you can destroy Russia with geopolitics, well, you make sure that you're gonna have another way to destroy something like Canada, right? Like global warming is a very Western thing, right? And some, for example, African cities are probably getting into that because they're getting some funds from somewhere. Yeah. Otherwise, there's no reason to do that. Okay, but I have a complete answer. I would say that there's many ways to destroy people. Global warming is one of them. Okay. That's not important. All right, so what I want to say is, I'm going to conclude with LaRouche. But think of it again about this idea of organizing. That's my main point. We're facing the imperialist networks promoting certain policies, selling them in a certain way to the population. And then we face our population, and they throw at us back those policies and spin the bit in a populist way. The government is taking your money. We're all going to die in 2012 because we won't be able to breathe. We need tolls, you know. We need to be innovative, right? So we get all these things, and when we look at where it comes from, well, we first see, okay, we got some pretty nasty dudes that we have to face, Rahat and Demiray. But that, I mean, it's sophistry. It's actually, when you take some time to look at it, it's not that hard to refute. But our problem is that our society itself doesn't seem that they want to take some time to sit down and read and go through, okay, what's the pay-as-you-go concept? What are the implications of that, right? And the problem is, when we think about the boomer culture, that's a bit what we're caught into. I mean, there's other problems with the youth culture, per se. But I think the last quote is very important by LaRouche to identify the problem of this culture, and you'll see what because as I was saying in the beginning, you see the difference between Malthus and LaRouche. Why LaRouche, his economics, is the complete refutation of Malthus. Because Malthus, what he does is that he attacks these concepts from the Genesis. Who is the idiot who told these poor people that they should go forth and multiply? Shouldn't they know that they can't sustain themselves? Suzuki does the same thing. His old book, he says, we're going to attack the sacred truth, right? Sacred truth. And then he goes, you can't go forth and multiply, you're going to create a genocide. You're going to create an ecological genocide. So let's read that from LaRouche, and then we can discuss that. Oops. Thank you. Yeah, and do a huge slideshow. Here. Anyone?
Who are those baby boomers? The baby boomers were not a generation, but rather a degeneration of a significant mere portion of the entire so-called white collar stratum born in the interval between the close of the 1939-1945 general warfare, and that stratum experience of their household experience of that relative depth of a great post-war economic recession reached approximately 1958. This was the culture of a special niche of the entire generation of that age group. Youngsters born and reared in these special cultural niches which social studies of the 1950s identified by such titles as white collar and the organization. These youngsters of that time reflected the impact of the cultural habits acquired in the household and the communities of their parents. Parents who had graduated into a certain kind of mature post-war life under the lights of Franklin Roosevelt, Hayden, Harry S. Truman, and Senator Joseph McCarthy. That during an interval of the general right-wing virtually pro-fascist term of nearly two decades following the 1944 Allied breakthrough in Normandy. In that context, the entire generation of the post-war baby boomer stratum in Europe and the Americas, most notably, underwent a more general moral, mental, and physical degeneration. Selections from among what were, more obviously, the anarchist bums and intellectual degenerates of the hardcore of the anarchoid 68ers were systematically selectively promoted to places selected for the fostering of their advancement in the emerging post-1968 establishments of the Americas, Europe, and elsewhere. Even many among those relatively more competent morally and intellectually, from among the same generation who were the achievers in the higher educational opportunities of the same time as the rising 68ers, were also struck, thus, with envy of the rising young anarchoid element rising toward influential posts within the establishment. This became an envy sensed increasingly as the useless bums drawn from the anarchoid hardcore of the baby of the boomer generation rose toward leading positions of political and cultural influence, leaving behind those boomers and others who actually embodied some degree of intellectual integrity and competence achievement. The latter exceptions were the others, who were distinct from the essentially depraved types such as the Al Gore fan. Meanwhile, the morally and intellectually inferior types were embedded to rise upward toward the top from among those, including outrightly predatory parasites, who should have been consigned morally and intellectually to the relatively lowest social and political ranks of what were to become the emerging elements of the ruling establishments. Envy promoted wider imitation of the rising influence of those relatively degenerate types. Seemingly, the prevailing mass of the socially influential drawn from the biological ranks of the white-collar stratum, born between 1945 and 1958, has accepted the hegemony of the leadership in politics and culture, represented by the anarchoid hardcore of their same presently leading political cultural generation. So, the political future of the USA today appears to have been turned upside down. Accepting the important, unique cases of relatively rare representatives
of a true intelligentsia actually in the higher ranks of society today. The honest essential leadership among the true patriots of our republic today is concentrated largely in the predominantly abused lower 80% of the family income bracket. A lower 80% whose expressed potential and actual influence is concentrated presently more in the state and local affairs rather than the more financially corrupted federal level of leadership. Only a terrible crisis which terrifies the political and comparable institutions at the national level into abandoning their whorish opportunity in favor of reality would unify the once more honest social political forces of our republic into becoming honestly Americans, rather than British butt-licking lackeys of the brutish empires George Soros and of their fascist Lazare Freres, heredity of former Pinochet associate Felix Rohan.
All right, so instead of saying where are the rich people that should live, and where are the poor people that should be sterilized, you actually have to look backward, to make it 180 and actually realize where the leadership will come from. And unless there's someone here winning $100,000 a day. but that's gonna be the way we're going to win. If we wake up the population to just certain of those ideas to get people through LaRouche's economics, right? Because it's not just a question of refuting all the bad guys. I mean, some of those are really insane. So we can laugh at them a lot. But then we're going to look at this question of the rate of increase of the relative potential population that's set up. But the way LaRouche measure economic growth, where you have to look at how many people you can sustain per area, right? And how you get to that point, right? People like Malthus is not able to identify what creates human growth. Right? Probably he's seen it, in certain isolated area, but he's deployed by the empire anyway to tell those poor people, forget it. Just forget it. Never mind. Right? Never mind all these ideas about the Genesis and you go forth and multiply. That was darkening your understanding, as he says in the beginning. So what we're going to do, we have to keep organizing, we have to keep recruiting towards a change in the financial system. But we have to see, each person here, when we talk about organizing, that's what I try to do. I try to think about what I'm facing personally in the street, or any type of academic or whatever that you meet, what type of things they're throwing at you. And we have to realize, right, that it's not necessarily academically okay. A lot of these things are just lies. Right? And we have a boomer strata that is falling for that. They want to have investment. They want to have a future. They can get, free chicks after a certain number of butt licking. And that's fine with them. That's how society collapses. So we have to identify that problem. At the same time, get people on the board.
I'm not sure whether this is the way the